Myanmar's story is one that has captivated and confounded the international community for decades. Francis Wade's Myanmar's Enemy Within offers a penetrating examination of how a country's transition from military dictatorship to democracy unleashed unexpected forces of religious nationalism and ethnic violence. Published in 2017, the book quickly became essential reading for anyone seeking to understand the complex dynamics behind Myanmar's troubled democratic experiment. Former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called it required reading for anyone wanting to understand the roots of violence in Rakhine State, while human rights organizations worldwide have used Wade's insights to inform their advocacy work. What makes this book particularly powerful is how it challenges our assumptions about democratization, revealing that the path to freedom can sometimes unleash dormant prejudices when not accompanied by strong institutions protecting minority rights. In a noisy Yangon tea shop, a university-educated young man leans forward to explain his mission, defending Buddhism by building a fence with our bones. This striking image captures the essence of Myanmar's predicament, a country where religious identity has become weaponized in the name of national survival. As Myanmar opened to the world after decades of isolation, shocking violence erupted between Buddhists and Muslims, particularly targeting the Rohingya minority. This violence didn't emerge spontaneously, but followed decades of careful social engineering by Myanmar's military rulers, who orchestrated a complex web of ethnic tensions through propaganda, policy, and strategic manipulation of public sentiment. The military junta that seized power in 1962 masterfully manipulated ethnic and religious differences to maintain control. By convincing the Buddhist majority that their faith and culture faced existential threats from ethnic minorities, the regime created a population willing to accept authoritarian rule as the price of security. They systematically categorized the country's diverse peoples into rigid ethnic categories, creating an artificial taxonomy of exactly 135 national races deemed indigenous to Myanmar. This classification became the foundation of citizenship itself. To belong legally in Myanmar, one had to belong to a recognized indigenous group. The military reinforced these divisions through education policy, media control, and carefully crafted public ceremonies that emphasized ethnic separation rather than unity. The Rohingya, despite centuries of documented presence in Rakhine State, were deliberately excluded from this list. Through successive military regimes, their rights were systematically stripped away. First, their citizenship, formalized in the 1982 Citizenship Act, then their freedom of movement, access to education, and eventually their very identity, as officials refused to acknowledge the name Rohingya, insisting instead on the pejorative term Bengali to imply they were illegal immigrants from Bangladesh. This systematic erasure extended to destroying historical records, removing Rohingya language from official documents, and restricting their participation in public life through increasingly draconian regulations. What makes this strategy particularly insidious is how effectively it transformed temporary political arrangements into seemingly timeless truths. The military's narrative that Myanmar's Buddhist identity was under threat from foreign elements became so deeply embedded in national consciousness that when democratic opening finally arrived, many citizens embraced exclusionary nationalism not as a departure from democratic values, but as their fulfillment. The fence built with bones wasn't just physical separation, but a psychological barrier that would prove remarkably resistant to change. This manufactured division manifested in everyday life through segregated communities, separate economic systems, and distinct social hierarchies that became normalized over generations. The military's long game extended beyond simple divide-and-rule tactics to include sophisticated psychological operations, targeted economic policies that deepened communal divisions, and the creation of parallel institutions that reinforced ethnic separation. Even seemingly benign cultural celebrations and religious festivals were carefully curated to emphasize differences rather than shared heritage, creating a society where division became the natural order rather than an imposed construct. The seeds of Myanmar's modern conflicts were planted during British colonial rule, with ramifications that continue to shape the nation's identity struggles today. Before colonization, the region contained remarkably fluid identities where people could shift ethnic affiliations based on political loyalties, trade relationships, or personal circumstances. The Konbaung dynasty maintained authority over the lowland territories through a sophisticated system of patronage and ritual relationships, while a complex patchwork of largely independent microstates occupied the mountainous borderlands. Though pre-colonial texts acknowledged ethnic distinctions, these boundaries remained porous, with intermarriage and cultural exchange common across group lines. The British imported their Victorian obsession with racial classification, dramatically transforming these fluid identities into rigid, fixed categories. Census enumerators, confronted with what they termed Baroque complexity, responded by implementing strict classification systems based primarily on language or geography. This approach ignored centuries-old kinship ties, political allegiances, and cultural practices that had previously defined social relationships. Myanmar was artificially divided into Burma proper, the central region governed by Bamar under British supervision, and the frontier areas of Kaya, Kachin, and Chin. This administrative ordering hardened previously flexible boundaries, ethnicizing the landscape and politicizing identity in unprecedented ways. Communities that had once freely interacted now found themselves separated by administrative boundaries and new social hierarchies. Colonial rule also dramatically altered Myanmar's religious landscape through multiple interventions. The British elimination of the border with India encouraged mass migration of Indians, both Muslim and Hindu, particularly into urban centers. By the early 1930s, Indians constituted more than half of Yangon's population, transforming the city's cultural and economic character. The impact extended beyond demographics. During the global recession, more than half the arable land in the fertile Irrawaddy Delta fell under the control of non-resident landlords, mostly Indian moneylenders and business owners. This dramatic shift in land ownership fueled deep resentment among the Bamar population, who increasingly felt their livelihoods and ancestral lands were being appropriated by foreigners under British protection. Perhaps most significantly, the British fundamentally misunderstood and subsequently disrupted the profound symbiotic relationship between Myanmar's monarchy and its Buddhist clergy. By forcibly removing King Thibaw Min in 1885, they severed a sacred bond that existed for centuries, where rulers served as chief preservers of Buddhist law, while the Sangha, monastic order, provided spiritual and political legitimacy to the monarchy. This disruption threatened the complex belief system that had unified Myanmar society through its integration of political and spiritual authority. The resulting vacuum would eventually be filled by nationalist movements seeking to restore Buddhism's central position in national life, leading to decades of religious political tension. The British administration's attempt to secularize governance ignored the deep spiritual foundations of Burmese society, creating enduring fault lines between traditional Buddhist values and imposed colonial structures. For individuals caught in Myanmar's complex web of ethnic politics, identity became a matter of survival rather than just self-expression. Hla Hla's family went to extraordinary lengths to secure her Bamar identity when they moved to Yangon. Despite being ethnically Mon, they bribed local authorities to alter their ID cards, completely fabricating their genealogy to erase her complex ancestry. Half-Muslim father, Chinese Mon grandfather. Beyond documentation, she had to transform her comportment. Me being dark, also the way I sit and walk, the way you dress, the way you hold yourself and behave. You have to be a city girl, not like in the village. This wasn't mere social climbing, but a calculated response to a system where ethnicity determined one's freedoms. Non-Bamar faced heightened surveillance, with police routinely questioning travelers about their race and registration. I didn't change my ID because of social pressure, but because of the way the government tried to control and discriminate, she explained. So although we are Mon, when we moved to Yangon, my mother said, no, we must be Bamar Buddhist because this is the highest identity we can get. Even more remarkable is the story of Umang So, a Rohingya Muslim who managed to join the military, an institution known for persecuting his people. When he turned 12 in 1978, the year Rohingya were forced to carry foreign registration cards, he and his parents changed their ethnicity to Rakhine Muslim, a recognized category before the 1983 census. Later, when joining the army at age 22, a Buddhist friend at the draft office wrote that he was Rakhine Buddhist on his form, initiating a second identity transformation. Despite being Rohingya, he rose to the rank of captain, even assisting the Na Sakha security force that oppressed his own people. These stories reveal something universal about Myanmar's ethnic divisions, that identity is not fixed but malleable, undermining nationalist claims of ethnic purity. The ease with which individuals could cross supposedly impermeable ethnic boundaries through simple paperwork maneuvers exposes the artificial nature of the categories themselves. As Umang So reflected, in a democracy, all the diverse people can cooperate with each other. I proved it myself. The military junta developed ambitious schemes to re-engineer northern Rakhine State's social landscape, systematically weakening the Rohingya while creating deeper divisions between Buddhists and Muslims. Their strategy materialized in a network of model villages populated by released Buddhist prisoners, homeless families, and Rakhine from the south, all part of a calculated demographic correction to counter what they perceived as the dangerous growth of Muslim population. In the mid-1990s, Buddhist inmates across Myanmar's prisons were offered early release in exchange for relocating to northern Rakhine State. Those who accepted were transported to newly built model villages around Buthadung, where they received houses, livestock, stipends, and monthly food rations. The fields surrounding these settlements were theirs to cultivate, creating permanent Buddhist fixtures in what the regime considered a region being lost to Muslims. The resettlement scheme originated from an 11-point strategy document circulated in 1988 within the Ministry for the Progress of Border Areas and National Races, NATALA. Colonel Tha Kya's directive explicitly aimed to strive for the increase in Buddhist population to be more than the number of Muslim people, through establishing these villages. The plan also outlined other suppressive measures, denying Rohingya higher education, banning mosque construction, restricting marriages, and systematically referring to them as insurgents to justify citizenship denial. These Na'tala villages deteriorated over time. Rations eventually stopped, and settlers who lacked farming skills struggled to survive. Villages like Shui Yin Ai devolved into communities plagued by alcoholism, gambling, and prostitution. Disease, particularly malaria, ravaged these settlements. The regime's attempt to establish facts on the ground proving Buddhism's foothold in Muslim-majority areas had created desperate communities with little connection to their surroundings. Beyond the Na'tala villages in Rakhine State, the regime established Na'tala schools in the 1990s, particularly in Chin State, targeting Christian communities. Unlike the strategy in Rakhine, which aimed to weaken rather than assimilate Muslims, these schools sought to actively cultivate ideological alignment with the state's three main national causes. Reports emerged of forced Buddhist conversion of Christian students who were attracted by free education and board, powerful incentives in a region where three-quarters lived below the poverty line. 9 months before the discovery of Ma Thita Hetway's body that triggered widespread violence in Rakhine State, tensions had been building through organized efforts to delegitimize Rohingya claims to belonging. Rakhine historians, political leaders, and intellectuals held seminars denouncing what they claimed was Rohingya appropriation of Rakhine heritage. A magazine called Piksham Ratwan began circulation with an editorial board including Rakhine monks, police chiefs, and government administrators, repeatedly portraying Rohingya as terrorists and an existential threat. On June 8, 2012, following a prayer ceremony at a Mangdal mosque for Muslims killed in a bus attack days earlier, confrontations erupted between Rohingya and Rakhine groups. After police allegedly shot at Rohingya, they began stoning Rakhine shops and later moved to outlying Natala villages, burning hundreds of houses. The Weekly 11 journal characterized these as Rohingya terrorist attacks and warned of ethnic cleansing or genocide, referring to the supposed threat Rohingya posed to Rakhine. Government silence on this inflammatory coverage allowed fear and resentment to crystallize into action. By June 12, violence reached Nasi Quarter in Sitwe, where Adu Shakur witnessed Rakhine attackers with machetes and flaming torches. After Nasi burned, the government moved Rohingya into camps like Thet Kai Pien, where over 5,000 lived in cramped wooden huts and tarpaulin shelters. What began as a temporary measure to ease tensions became permanent segregation, enthusiastically supported by Rakhine political powers who viewed the camps as rightful places for Rohingya confinement. High walls, both literal and figurative, rose between the communities. In July 2012, Rakhine monks issued directives commanding Buddhists to cease all contact with Bengali Kalar, forbidding their employment in ports, farms, and businesses. By October, monks at Dakong Monastery in Sitwe threatened to expose any Rakhine who assisted Rohingya as national traitors, publishing their photos, echoing Rwanda's targeting of Hutu moderates who had helped Tutsis. The pressure was so intense that when a Rakhine man was caught selling rice to a Muslim in Mrau Ku, fellow Rakhine beat him to death. Meanwhile, anti-Muslim sentiment was spreading beyond Rakhine state. By 2013, violence had erupted nationwide. In Mithila, three Muslim quarters were completely destroyed. Similar violence occurred in Akan, Lashio, and Hangon. What had begun as localized conflict between ethnic groups in Rakhine State had transformed into nationwide Buddhist-Muslim violence. What shocked observers almost as much as the violence itself was the public response to it. Not only did Rakhine crowds jeer at Rohingya as they fled destroyed homes, but unexpected voices from the pro-democracy movement joined the chorus of resentment. Koko G, who spent 17 years imprisoned for opposing the junta, declared Rohingya absolutely not an ethnic race of Burma and suggested that democratic forces might join hands with the military to resolve this national affair. The NLD remained conspicuously quiet on violence toward Rohingya. Aung San Suu Kyi took an ambivalent line, arguing that violence has been committed by both sides and refusing to take sides to work toward reconciliation. Her reluctance to acknowledge the widespread racism feeding the violence revealed a deeper problem. The Rohingya had never featured on the pro-democracy movement's radar, nor been included in calls for ethnic equality. Suu Kyi consistently avoided using the term Rohingya and evaded direct questions, speaking vaguely about clarifying citizenship laws without addressing their prejudicial basis. By early 2013, anti-Muslim sentiment had spread beyond Rakhine State through the 969 movement. Initiated by U Wimala, a monk from Malamyin, the movement distributed stickers bearing the numbers 969, representing Buddhist attributes, to counter the Muslim practice of marking shops with 786, representing a Quranic phrase. For many Burmese, Buddhism represented not just faith, but national identity, a sanctuary during military rule that they believed needed protection. After the 969 movement was declared illegal by the government-appointed State Sangha Mahanayaka Committee in August 2013, a new, more organized group emerged, the Organization for Protection of Race, Religion, and Sasana, known as Ma Batha. With millions of supporters, departments for education, legal affairs, accounting, and media, it wielded significant political influence. Ma Batha successfully pushed through the discriminatory protection of race and religion laws in 2014 despite NLD opposition. These laws criminalized polygamy, required official permission for religious conversion, allowed local governments to limit women's reproductive rates in overpopulated regions, and subjected Buddhist-non-Buddhist marriages to public scrutiny. Those who opposed Ma Batha's agenda faced severe consequences. When women's rights campaigner May Sabe Phu signed a public statement against the laws, Ma Batha labeled her a national traitor. She received death threats, had her phone number posted on adult websites, and was sent explicit images. Her children were also threatened. Despite her decade of campaigning against military abuses, she had never experienced such targeted intimidation. The violence of 2012 in Rakhine State created an intricate system of segregation that fundamentally transformed the social fabric of the region. Rohingya were systematically banished from towns where they had lived and worked for generations, their homes and businesses abandoned or seized. Markets, schools, hospitals, and other public facilities that had previously served all communities became strictly off-limits, enforced through a complex network of checkpoints and surveillance that effectively imprisoned Rohingya within their villages. Even attempting to cross these invisible but rigorously enforced boundaries became a criminal offense, punishable by fines, detention, or worse. In January 2015, the human cost of this segregation was starkly illustrated through the tragedy of Arif, a Rohingya shopkeeper whose story became emblematic of the system's cruelty. When his pregnant wife developed life-threatening complications, they faced an impossible situation. Just 4 years earlier, in 2011, they could have reached Kalktal Hospital in minutes. Now they were forced to navigate an exhausting bureaucratic maze, requiring multiple permissions from different authorities, none of whom treated the medical emergency with urgency. After an excruciating 36-hour wait for clearance and transport arrangements, they had to undertake a grueling 3-hour journey to Sitwe Hospital instead of the 10-minute drive to their local facility. The devastating outcome, the death of both mother and child, was compounded by the final indignity of Arif being forcibly removed by police and denied the right to attend his wife's funeral. The physical segregation imposed after June 2012 created deep psychological barriers that transformed longtime neighbors into perceived enemies. In Pardalek village, the transformation was particularly evident in the case of administrator Min U's son. Despite having shared meals and overnight stays with his Rohingya friend, he now claimed to get a fever merely at the sight of Muslims. His chilling explanation, "Before 2012, I didn't think that way. After 2012, I think they're bad," revealed how quickly manufactured hatred could override years of personal friendship and shared experiences. The enforcement of segregation became increasingly decentralized, with Rakhine civilians taking on unofficial policing roles. This vigilante enforcement was demonstrated in a 2015 incident near Mrauk U, where a critically injured Rohingya man was prevented from reaching medical care by armed Rakhine villagers who had set up their own checkpoint. The man was forced to return home without treatment, highlighting how civilian enforcement had become as effective as official restrictions in controlling Rohingya movement. The violence created a complex web of informal regulations that erased long-standing distinctions between different Muslim groups. Even the Kaman people, who held official Myanmar citizenship and had centuries of recognized presence in the region, found themselves targeted. The case of Ma Win from Thinganet village illustrated this brutal shift. A common woman who had peacefully traded in Sitwe markets for 3 decades was subjected to an hour-long beating by Rakhine women who had been her regular trading partners and customers. This incident exposed how the violence transcended ethnic boundaries to target religious and racial differences, with darker-skinned individuals increasingly marked as outsiders regardless of their legal status or historical ties to the region. While much of Myanmar experienced violent Buddhist-Muslim conflict during the transition, some areas maintained fragile coexistence. In northern Rakhine State, the town of Buthadong, where Muslims outnumber Buddhists, avoided the violence and segregation that afflicted Sitwe and other towns. Here, communities continued interacting in tea shops, schools, and marketplaces, demonstrating that segregation persists only where calculated to benefit the dominant group. In Buthadong, a dilapidated cinema hut screening English Premier League matches became one of the few spaces where Rohingya and Rakhine still gathered as social equals. Inside this musty building with its peeling walls and mismatched seating, religious and ethnic divisions temporarily dissolved as fans hollered side by side, sharing a camaraderie absent elsewhere in the state. In East Tonbin, Win Zhao and his wife Mia showed signs of healing relations with their Rohingya neighbors. Though Win Zhao had voted for the Arakan National Party and claimed 70% of Muslims were dishonest, he and Mia now welcomed Rohingya vendors from South Tonbin, who sold fish and vegetables. When a young Rohingya fisherman arrived with malaria symptoms, they showed genuine concern, with Mia offering to contact a doctor. Among the heroes working quietly against violence was U With Huda, a Buddhist abbot who, during the 2013 Maktila violence, opened his monastery to both Buddhist and Muslim refugees. When mobs demanded he surrender the Muslims, including the gold shop owner's family whose dispute had sparked the violence, he refused. "If you want to get them, you have to kill me first." By the fourth day, 940 people sheltered in his compound. Initially separated, but eventually mingling together, sharing food, witnessing births, and even a death. His monastery became a sanctuary where people of different faiths found solidarity amid chaos, offering a hopeful vision for Myanmar's future. Even in areas where social engineering had most deeply divided communities, individuals continued to bridge ethnic and religious divides. In late 2015, a group of Rohingya and Rakhine men played chin loan together in a paddy field south of Mongdal, their game set against a rainbow arching over the hills, a powerful symbol of possibility. Despite Myanmar's rainbow nation of diverse cultures being undermined by those promoting division, these connections persisted quietly. The transition brought unprecedented freedoms to Myanmar, exemplified by Muslims gathering in Kanyuar's mosque to learn about democratic processes, an activity that would have led to imprisonment not long before. Yet alongside these freedoms, dangerous forces emerged. The NLD had an opportunity to break with the military's narrative that ethnic and religious diversity threatens national stability. Instead, the party, dominated by privileged Bamar, focused on rule of law and development in Rakhine State without addressing the stigmatization of Rohingya identity. Wade's book concludes with both warning and hope. The warning came true in August 2017 when massive military operations forced over 700,000 Rohingya to flee to Bangladesh in what UN investigators later called a genocide. Yet the hope remains in those quiet heroes who risked everything to protect their neighbors across religious divides, proving that Myanmar's future could still be one where diversity becomes a source of strength rather than division.